Right off the bat, I have to apologize for the title being slightly misleading. The title is How the Brain Solves the Cocktail Party Problem, Evidence from Human Auditory Neuroscience. It really should be That the Brain Solves the Cocktail Party, Evidence from Human Auditory Neuroscience. I'm not able to explain how at this point, and I would like to get there. So if you'd like to leave now. But this is a lot of evidence that the brain solves the problem, as opposed to that it just happens, because we're seeing neural correlates, neural underpinnings, perhaps neural causes of solving the cocktail party problem. Is the volume too loud, or is it just where I'm standing? Okay, good. All right, so a shameless plug. This is a book that I just co-edited on the auditory system, not the cocktail party. I encourage everyone to look for it. As opposed to that, a valuable resource would be chapter 7 in this book, which is Human Auditory Neuroscience and the Cocktail Party Problem. And that chapter overlaps a lot with the tutorial I'm giving today.
Can you put a PDF on the wiki space?
So I cannot put a PDF of this book chapter on the wiki space.
Springer
really does not like that. So what it takes is, but if anyone should happen to send me an email request for a PDF, I'd be happy to honor that. No, that Springer gets very unhappy with that. Yes. But as I said, if anyone should happen to send me an email request, then I would be very quick to respond to that. And I should also point out that chapter 2 of this book, and you didn't hear this from me, if you go to the Springer website that has this book where you can buy it, they have a sample chapter that you can download for free. Which is not mine, but it's a very good one. It's by Barbara Shin Cunningham. Way too much money. All right, so what I'll be talking about today is a quick outline of what the cocktail party problem is in my mind, although Malcolm has covered a lot of that already, and then followed by a quick outline of what does it mean to do human auditory neuroscience. Human auditory neuroscience is different in practice than animal auditory neuroscience. And then I'll talk about different versions of cocktail parties that are simplified because as scientists, and especially as experimentalists, and especially as theorists, we like to simplify things before we attack them. So we'll talk about versions or models of a cocktail party that just use tones instead of speech, some with and some without directed attention, and then simplified versions of cocktail parties that have speech. And then, if there's time at the end, some recent results on some perceptual filling in and neural filling in. So what is the cocktail party problem? So the cocktail party problem, in its essence, is many people talking at the same time, and a listener whose job it is not to bring in, to take in everything that's going on at the cocktail party, but to take in the speech sound, the voice of one person at the cocktail party at the expense of everything else, of everyone else. But at the same time, even though this man is ostensibly interested in this woman, if the person behind him is talking about stock tips, then all of a sudden his attention might be directed there instead of to the woman he's ostensibly having a conversation with. So this is an example from a lower Manhattan cocktail party in some loft. Here's a more appropriate version of a cocktail party. There's a bunch of people standing around at the beach having a beer with the waves breaking in the background. This is a different kind of cocktail party, but the brain has to solve it just the same way. Now we have noise not just from, not just speech noise, but we also have additional noise. We have the waves breaking in the background. It's very non-stationary. It is a signal all by itself. I was having a discussion with Anki before about what noise is. If you're trying to listen to a conversation, the waves are noise. If the conversations are boring and you just want to take in the sound of the waves, the people are noise and the waves become your signal. There are many interrelated processes that have to do with the cocktail party problem. The traditional cocktail party problem is that there are multiple speech streams. There's many people talking at the same time. But that has a lot of overlap with the field of auditory scene analysis, which is doesn't have to be speech, but there are multiple sound sources that it is our job to analyze the scene of the entire auditory scene, break it up into different things that perceptually have been called auditory objects. They don't have to be physical sources. They identify as auditory objects by brains. Related to that is the idea of stream segregation. If you have many, if you have a complex sound scene, then there are some statistical properties that some parts of that sound scene have in common. So for instance, if many different frequencies share a common onset and share a common offset, then we will tend to group those. And especially so if they are harmonically related to each other, but not necessarily. At the same time, if one of those harmonically related components gets shifted so it's not harmonically related, then that can be segregated out, even if it shares common onsets and offsets. So the part of stream segregation is actually identification. It's not the segregation, it's the unification. And then once some unifications have been done, then those groups of unifications can be segregated as streams. And then there's other concepts that are related to what goes on in cocktail party processing, such as filling in. Filling in is the perceptual construct of when there is a sound that is expected, but is not actually acoustically present, and yet it is heard, even though it is not there. So if we go back to the cocktail party, which is different speech streams all coming at you at once, there's many different cues that we can use to help us determine what the different auditory objects are, what the different sources are. One of them is pitch, sometimes called F0. That can be very useful when it exists. Not all sound objects have a pitch, and even those that do, when you're speaking, the pitch will turn on and off depending on what sound you're making. Vowels typically have pitch, unless you're whispering. Consonants typically don't. Timbre, which is just a catch-all phrase, which means many different things, but includes spectral envelope, whether there's some vibrato in the sound, probably half a dozen other things that can be thrown in there. Higher order ideas, such as the sex of the speaker, the age of the speaker, especially if it's a child, accents, the language that the person is talking. The thing that binds all of these is that these are derived quantities, they're not intrinsic. They may be very easy to derive or not easy to derive if you have a single sound source, but when you have multiple sound sources, it's not obvious how to derive any one of these, even pitch. Along those lines is, we don't know what the number of sources are. We have to estimate that. The number of sources, in fact, may be much larger than we can do the cocktail party for. There may be 30 people in a room, and sometimes we can pick out two of them. Sometimes we could pick out four of them and attend to them individually. And then just another higher order concept that goes in here is the statistics of that stream, because knowing something about what one of the sources is doing can help you anticipate what is going to happen next. And the statistics might be something about pitch, but they might be something having to do with the language. It could be any one of these objects that statistics matters. Yeah.
Derived versus intrinsic. What is considered intrinsic?
So great question. So intrinsic to me means if you're using vision, you have two-dimensional retinal image. In fact, we have two of them. You don't have to derive anything about where things are on the two-dimensional scene. They're just there. Anything that goes into the cochlea and is separated out by frequency, is not, doesn't have to be derived, it's there at the periphery. But things like pitch, or things like three-dimensional location, depth in terms of vision, those have to be derived further on in the brain.
And why do those cues, suppose they're derived cues, why do they need to be reconstructed?
Since they're not intrinsic, so reconstructed is a funny word here. Reconstructed usually means something is true out in the physical world, and we're able to construct something internally that corresponds to that. But they're not reconstructed in the sense that we don't know what they are. We construct them internally, the brain does, and we hope or assume that they do have something to do with the outside world. So maybe I should give an example of that, because that was a little vague.
You just mean how a cue is derived or constructed, not reconstructed. I think reconstruction, I think of, I have a bunch of measurements, I want to reconstruct the image. Or I have a bunch of, you know, low resolution measurements, but I want a high resolution image. I'm trying to reconstruct the ground truth.
Yeah.
That's not what you mean here. You just mean perceptual construction.
No, I do mean that deeper. So, I mean, for instance, in this example I like to use, and we'll see it, is two people talking at the same time, a man and a woman to make it easier, mixed into a single audio channel, presented diodically, the same in both ears. What's going into your ears, there is no man's voice, there is no woman's voice, there is only the mixture. But we hear, if we're attending to the male, we hear the man's voice. So we have reconstructed that, even though it didn't exist in our ears. But common uses that we can reconstruct it instead of construct it. Yeah, I'll call that reconstruction. All right, human auditory neuroscience. For the most part with humans, you have to use what we call functional brain imaging, but what I mean by functional brain imaging is any non-invasive recording from human brains. That's just a good working definition of functional brain imaging. There are two main types of non-invasive recording from the human brain or functional brain imaging. They're the ones that fall into hemodynamic techniques, which measure neural activity indirectly by changes in the blood flow or changes in the oxygen level in the blood flow. And there are ones that use electromagnetic techniques. These are ones that use Maxwell's equations. Because we're at the physics of hearing. We use Maxwell's equations to measure electrical or magnetic signals, or both, and then infer what the underlying currents were that that originated them. There are more than these four, but these are the biggest. There's some new up-and-coming ones, such as NIRS. There's also invasive recording methods for humans. These are used only in very special circumstances when the subject needs these invasive techniques to be used anyways for medical reasons. So typically this is for epilepsy patients that have intractable epilepsy that is not helped out by medication, then surgery may be their only option as far as the medical community is concerned. So since they're going in and removing the scalp, leaving the brain exposed, putting in electrodes anyways, then one can ask whether these patients would like to take part in an experiment. ECOG, which is electrocorticography, puts arrays of electrodes on the surface of the cortex. And they can be an array, a linear array, or they can be a square array. And then depth electrodes literally take pieces of sharp metal and stick them into cortex. This was the old-fashioned way and works pretty well, although presumably causes some tissue damage. But it's from the point of view of the of epilepsy surgery, it does much more good than harm to do this. These are much more modern techniques. But even today, there are plenty of neurosurgeons that will do both, depending on the need. All right, cocktail parties. So the first evidence that I know of, it's certainly the most prominent one, was from Hilliard et al. In 1973 from Picton's group. They have a very simple auditory scene. I don't have any sounds on the computer, I'm just going to make them myself. In one ear you have beep, 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 and in the other ear you have beep, 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 beep. And that's an auditory scene, that's something that has two components to it, one in each ear, and in this case they gave the subjects the task of something that involved listening to one or the other. They didn't actually just say, listen to the high one, listen to the low one, listen to the left, listen to the right. They gave them a task so that they knew that the subjects would had encouragement to pay attention to the one they wanted, and also they could measure how well they did. And what they found was, not too surprisingly, because they're listening to tones, and they used EEG, was that there was a strong N1 response. The N1 response is a strong negative peak with about 100 milliseconds latency. You can see that all three of these subjects have strong N1 responses, both when the stimulus was in the right ear and when the stimulus was in the left ear. I should mention that this EEG experiment used a single electrode placed at the top of the head. They also found that whichever stream that the subject was attending to because of their task was enhanced. So in this case, for the right ear stimulus, it goes up. For the left-hand stimulus, it goes down because the coding is that the solid is attend right and the dashed is attend left. So it looks like it reverses, but in fact, it's always enhanced. Always meaning for these three subjects, for this one EEG electrode. Historically, this has been called the neural correlate of a selective attention. You decide to attend to one over the other, and the response to that is enhanced. I'd like to pull away from that a little bit, and we'll see why more later in this talk. But I think a perfectly reasonable interpretation of this is a neural correlate of successful auditory scene segregation. You've segregated them either because they're high or low, or because they're left or right, doesn't matter how, and once you've segregated them, one becomes the foreground, the other one is in the background, and the foreground stream is the one that is modulated upward. So, given that, I'm going to talk about some complex auditory scenes, but ones that are relatively simple. For me, a complex scene is one that has more than one source in it, more than one auditory object in it, but these are still relatively simple compared to that. The first thing I'm going to do is all of these experiments, and when I say me, I mean this is the ones I'm talking about. Many of these experiments, maybe most, are not mine, is to remove spatial information from them. Spatial information, if you're at a cocktail party, is really useful. When speakers are distinct from each other spatially, that helps enormously perceptually in being able to segregate them, but it's not necessary, and it's not fundamental. So I gave the example of two people talking at the same time, man and a woman mixed into a single channel. You could easily imagine this occurring over an old-fashioned radio. Two people talking, they've got one channel, one speaker, you can attend to the man or the woman, it's really not a problem. That is assuming you have a healthy hearing, healthy auditory system, that you're relatively young, that they're speaking in your native language. There's all kinds of things that can mess that up, but for the most part, it's really a very simple problem that most people would do without thinking about it. Given that, there's other cues that are still going to be needed because we've taken away the spatial cue, so there'll be these other cues which would be tone frequency, or maybe beat rhythm, or when it's possible, timbre. So in this first set of experiments I'm talking about, there's no attentional manipulation involved here. So it's not that we're saying, listen to stream A or stream B. These are ambiguous auditory scenes. And so they have distinct percepts, two or more distinct percepts, despite being a single stimulus. And what this does, these are the earlier ones done in the history of these experiments. They got away from having to change the stimulus in order to change the percept. The first sets of experiments of all these, the way they changed the percept was they changed the stimulus, which makes a lot of sense from a historical point of view, but there's an obvious confound there. So these stimuli get away from that confound. A very common set of stimuli to use for this kind of experiment are auditory stream or streams due to Van Noorden. In this stimulus type, we have tone pips at frequency A and tone pips at frequency B, and the tone pips at frequency A occur twice as often as those at B, and then depending on how closely the A's and the B's are in time and how closely or far they are apart in frequency, you'll either hear ABA, 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 or you'll hear AAAAA. At the same time, you're hearing B, 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 B. And if you put them in a range where they're pretty close, they're in the middle between being obviously two streams or one stream, then they can go either way. Yeah?
What is close and what is far in frequency and in time?
The short answer is I can't give you specific numbers, I don't know them. The longer answer is it depends, and depending on how close they are in time, it changes the frequency and vice versa. But the rhythms that I just did for you are good examples of when they will be around that range. And so this is a visual version of when they're segregated. This is a visual version of when they're integrated. I wrote here one stimulus, two percepts. Depending on the task, I would actually argue that in some cases, this would be one stimulus, three percepts. Because if you've integrated this into one stream, then that's the foreground and there is no background. If you've segregated it and you're attending to one or the other, then you have two different percepts, the one that's louder that you're attending to, and the one that's quieter that's gone to the background or the flip, depending on your state of attention. But
the terminology here, just for clarification, what is the distinction between integrated and segregated? Is clear, but integrated, what is?
It means that the two frequency ranges have been integrated into one.
So you have an object, you have an auditory object that spans across multiple frequency ranges.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the literature, integration and segregation are used as the opposites. So this is work by Gottschalk and his lab in 2005. They actually did two sets of experiments. They used these Van Noorden streams, and they showed that when you do change the stimulus by changing the frequency separation, that as you, first of all, as is well known, behaviorally, as you change the frequency separation, then you're more likely to report that you report separated streams as opposed to integrated streams. And then using MEG, magnetoencephalography, they noted that increasing together, as frequency separation increases and the probability of segregation increases, then you get larger P1s, which are responses about 50 milliseconds, and N1s, which are responses about 100 milliseconds latency, and the P and the N, positive and negative, refer to that they are different orientations. In this case, it's a magnetic field. It's not actually positive or negative voltage. It's just a convention that one of them we call, the one that's 100 milliseconds we call N, the one that's 50 milliseconds has the opposite magnetic field polarity, we call that P. So then what they did, which was interesting, is they looked at constant frequency separation. They no longer changed the stimulus, but they put it in this range where it could go either way. It could be segregation or integration, and it was more or less by chance. It's more or less by chance because they determined for each subject what that frequency separation should be. And they showed that, in this case, the orange is two streams. When it was perceived as two streams, that the P1 and the N1 both were enhanced just as though the frequency had separated. So in that way, they were able to tease apart this confound of segregation increasing with frequency separation, and they got it to just the probability of perceiving it as segregated, that enhanced the signal. So now they have a dissociation between the stimulus and the perception, and they've got a neural correlate of that. So they're seeing something in the brain that is not just stimulus-based, although it is representing a stimulus. I should mention also that Joel Snyder's group has done very similar work. They use different methodologies, and they still have a little bit more of the increase of changing the stimulus in there, but they certainly agree in all of the major findings. And then this same group, 6 years later, did this with ECOG and found very similar results. Yeah.
So the phrenology aspect of this bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
And I admit there's a change, and that's good. But isn't it just as likely it could have been the other way around? I mean, they got quite fortuitous that they got the neurons oriented exactly the right way for EEG or MEG to see this. And actually, MEG and EEG look at different angles, right?
No, they tend to see the same sources. They can be complementary. EEG can see things that MEG can't, and vice versa.
I think their angle of the currents are different too.
No, no.
MEG is more sensitive to the directions because it feels facing the head, whereas EEG, because looking at the current, it spreads everything.
Yeah, so I can amplify that. EEG sees everything. And so therefore, if you can't see something with EEG, you could see with MEG, it's probably because it's being masked by some other thing going on. MEG is blind to many things, including most subcortical responses and many cortical responses, depending on the orientation. But in practice, that gives you a much cleaner signal because it's seeing fewer things. So there's pros and cons.
And the point I wanted to ask is, I mean, it's good to get a change. Is a sign actually important, or do you think that's, do you really believe the sign?
The sign of P1 versus N1, or the sign of enhancement?
Enhancement, yeah, versus a change going the other direction.
No, I think that's ubiquitous. That's just going to occur in everything we see. And there are reasons for that, and we'll see those later on. This is a tutorial, this is still early on in the history. Do you have a question, Jim?
I just wonder, you make this sound almost as if it's a categorical distinction. Is the psychometric curve really steep, so that a slight change in length, for example, suddenly takes you from a segregated to an unsegregated?
It's not that steep. In fact, in this middle area, it can spontaneously change from one to the other. So you may hear one thing for the first few seconds, but as you wait many, many seconds, it can spontaneously change from one to the other.
Can you control that?
There's some control, but even that control disappears.
You can bias it.
You can definitely bias it, absolutely.
You can
hear
both.
Can you hear both?
No, you can hear both.
Both at the same time? Yeah. Okay, I've never been able to do that. But maybe you're switching. Not all of it. So I also want to talk about fMRI and PET. These measures that we've been talking about before, these Van Noorden streams, which are so easy to see with MEG or EEG, are, for whatever reasons, difficult to see with fMRI and PET. And even if you do a manipulation of the stimulus to change the percept, that's still hard to see. Most of the effects seen with these techniques are outside of auditory cortex. In particular, IPST, intraparietal sulcus, was seen by Rodrigue Cusack, but even then only by changing the actual acoustics, so that you were sure that the stimulus was being heard as one version or the other. That's in contrast to EEG and MEG, where we're using these averaged and phase-locked responses, and so they're dominated by the parts of the cortex that phase-lock, which tend to be auditory cortex. Some groups, Gutschalk's group, has said has shown that if you change the pattern, so it's not a stereotypical ABA pattern, that you get better results with fMRI, and they say that's by avoiding habituation, and that may indeed be true, but it gets us away from this sort of standard stimulus, which is so widely used.
Within the auditory cortex, is there, are there particular hot zones which are more correlated with the percept?
Yes, yes.
And auditory cortex means primary auditory cortex?
Auditory cortex means any part of cortex that responds to sounds, and in particular, in, with these methods, responds in a phase-locked way.
But there's a tautological problem, right? You can't see effects outside of auditory cortex if they're driven auditorily, by definition.
Okay, so we can't, with MEG and to some extent with EEG, we can do some localization, and that helps us say that it's near, it's consistent with auditory cortex, and not consistent with visual cortex, not consistent with prefrontal cortex. But it is, with both of those techniques, a little bit messy. So here's another stimulus type that's used the same way. This is an informational masking paradigm where you have a tone pip stream, beep, 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 or in the first case I'll show it's beep, beep, beep. And at the same time, you've got this tone cloud, which is a form of noise, which makes it hard to perceive or find this rhythmic tone stream. It's deliberately, in this case, there's a what's called a safety zone here, frequency safety zone, to make sure that there's no energetic masking. For those of the audience who knows what that is, this is purely informational masking, because this is typically 8 semitones. So there's
eight.
It can be more, could be less, but the goal is that this is more interesting when it's informational masking, so you don't have to worry about energetic masking coming in as well. I just wanted to bring back the beach party. This is something like the beach party because you have this extra background which you can consider noise, and we'll see also that you can also consider this a signal if you'd like. So this is Gutschalk's group again, doing an MEG experiment. In this case, this is what happens if you turn off the background, the random tones, and you just look at the MEG response as a function of when the tone pip was played. And you get this nice N1M, the magnetic N1 response, and that's called the targets only. If you do the same thing when you don't have any targets and you only have the maskers, and you average based on when the targets would have been had there been maskers, you expect very little response because you're averaging, and that's in fact what you get. So this is what background noise looks like. So then the real question is when the subjects are listening to these, and they're coming about 1 a second, they can press a button when they have heard this rhythmic tone stream, and they don't press the button, or I forget, they press a different button if they don't hear the rhythmic tone stream. And so you can average based on when the tone pip was, based on whether or not they heard an element of that tone stream. And in fact, when the tone stream is undetected, so it was present acoustically, and there's no energetic masking here, and you average, it looks indistinguishable from when there weren't any target tones at all. Whereas if you average when they detected, when they perceived the tone stream, then you see that there is a response, and it's certainly not as strong as the undisturbed tone response, but it's in the right direction, and it's got the comparable strength here. So this is another example, because remember, these are identical stimuli here. So this is another example of taking a neural response that has become dissociated from the actual stimulus.
Has anybody linked that to what happens in the brain stem? I mean, that you would assume that this does not happen, right? That you get onset responses whether or not you perceive the stimuli, although obviously the louder the stimulus is, the bigger the response, but then you get a more gradual change.
Yeah, I don't know that anyone. So auditory nerve, I'm not sure. Probably, because it would be so easy. In midbrain, in IC, you can do EEG, and you find that there's very, very little effect of perception. It's acoustically driven. And so where we'll be going is, I'm just realizing that clock is not really very helpful. All right, that's not going to work either. So where we'll be going with this, though, is that change between acoustic representation and perceptual representation is occurring in cortex, and that there are parts of cortex that represent the entire scene much better than any one stream, and there are parts that represent the foreground component much better. This they did localize this. This is in auditory cortex, and it's a particular part called planum temporale, which is not core auditory cortex. It's not A1. It's not clear in humans whether this is belt or parabelt, but it is certainly outside primary-like areas of auditory cortex. This is just to acknowledge that fMRI has also been done with this. And they just, when not looking at phase lock responses, but just looking at neural activity that is then followed by changes in blood flow, they see widespread activation across auditory cortex, but they don't see contrast in these two cases anywhere except in Heschel's gyrus. Heschel's gyrus is the source of A1, primary auditory cortex. So there's something funny going on here that doesn't quite agree. So one would acknowledge that.
And so if you signal with MEG, that you basically, so I guess we would expect that there might be some source in auditory cortex, say primary auditory cortex or so, that actually is not sensitive, whether it's a percept or not. That is maybe independent of that, but you're saying you don't see any such source.
Yeah,
that basically corresponds to the perceptron.
So you can, with MEG and EEG, you can often look at the latency, and that's a very good indicator of where it's occurring, because there's certain areas that are just very neurally loud. And in this case, that's at 100 milliseconds, and that's clear, and that's the planum temporale. The one at 50 milliseconds, the P1M, is not present in this for whatever reason. And there's any number of reasons why that's a reasonable thing to happen. It's hard to get the M50, the M1M, the P1M. Okay, so we've got... I'm going to ignore this because I didn't really talk about multiple cortical representations. Oh yeah, okay. No, I guess I see now what I meant. Okay, so we have an acoustic scene. We have different auditory responses to the same stimuli in those scenes. Therefore, we're talking about different representations, especially since it's aligned with the percept, that there are some parts of this that only care about the stimulus, and there are other parts that seem to only care about what the percept is. This is just really saying the same thing. We're going to see with MEG and EEG that these later, meaning 100 millisecond percepts originating in planum temporale, are the main source of the signals that dissociate from the acoustics. There's no simple answer to that, because there's many places where we get subcortical inputs to cortex, but for the most part, it's safe to say that there's many synapses between the thalamus and planum temporale in these higher orders. And 100 milliseconds is a fair amount of time. Now, 100 milliseconds is the peak; it's not the origin, but still, even if it's starting to get these signals at 50 milliseconds. For anyone who works in cat or ferret, that's like the Everything in A1 is long over since then.
So then you would presume that it's after A1, after a certain amount of processing in A1 and other places, it kind of gets there after 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, although also remember, just as Malcolm said, there's no... If you're imagining this as only a feed-forward system, you're already doomed.
Already doomed, but if you how quickly are these persons? So envision we have these studies where people, how quickly can you recognize an object? Right? 90 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds is all you need. And there's not enough time for lateral or recurrent interactions to have had any effect. So we can talk about the feed-forward part.
No, absolutely true. But we'll also see that these kinds of 100 millisecond latencies, for which it's way too short for there to be any language involvement, for instance, are affected by language in the scene itself. And that's part of this, what I was referring to with Malcolm's talk as the state. If you're aware that there's other languages in the scene, then apparently things are processed differently than when they're not. All right, so this is still simple, complex scenes, but now we're going to put some attention in there. Yeah?
Well, can't we just say, based on your definition at the beginning, that the more direct frequency cues would be, you could say the direct frequency cues versus the derived will be at different levels as well in that last slide?
Let me go back. The next one?
Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
I'm sorry. Not that important. This one, right? So you're saying if some measures track the perceptive sound, the implication there is they could precede it, except that the short onset times or peak times, versus others more the perceptive sound as an acoustic isolated object.
Yeah, so I'd like to say that if I'm seeing a neural correlate of perception, and it's at 100 milliseconds, which as far as percept is pretty early, that it's probably not following from the percept. It's more likely to be a cause of the percept. But I have no evidence for that, so I don't want to be strong either way. If it were 500 milliseconds, I would say, okay, there's some recognition this was the percept, and then the causal relationship would be percept generates neural response. At 100 milliseconds, it's still pretty early. And there's so many synapses going on between that. Okay, so in this case, we're still using only tones, we still have an ambiguous auditory scene, we still avoid the confound of a stimulus-dependent percept, but we're going to use directed attention to change the percept of the scene. And I say mostly there because we instruct our subjects to do something, we encourage them to do something, we say pay attention to this, we give them rewards for paying attention to this, but it doesn't actually mean they'll do it, it doesn't actually mean they'll be successful, and if you drift off, then it could weaken the results, and then in some sense that makes the results look slightly conservative. But mostly it's directed attention. And so we're going to be using, in this case, this informational masking paradigm again. This was Al-Hilali, who we've heard a lot about today. So we have this steady rhythmic stream. In this case, it's 4 hertz. So it's beep, 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 beep. We've got this masking tone cloud around it. In this case, for this experiment, we always have attention on, and we redirect attention to either this rhythmic tone stream by having the subjects try to find these little frequency deviants. So it's beep, 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 beep. We also have in the background some temporal deviants. So it's beep, 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 beep. And depending on, these are pretty hard tasks. When you're trying to find this stream in this mess, you're incentivized to do that, but it may take many cycles of this rhythm before you can do it, and it's hard enough, you're using basically a random search strategy, it's an auditory Where's Waldo task, that most subjects do not hear these deviants in the background. And similarly, when you're listening for these deviants in the background, there's no incentive to find this rhythmic stream, And so without picking out the stream, you don't hear the frequency deviant. So what we did actually, this is just a very clever thing that I'm proud of, we used identical stimuli in all cases, identical deviants, so that the subjects really heard the same sounds twice. And when we asked the subjects in exit interviews what they thought about the different kinds of tasks, they had no indication that they were the same sounds, and they believed that they were different sounds according to the task. So that's, that dissociates that perceptually. So when they're in the target task, which is to listen for these deviants, and we ask what happens neurally, and then here I'm going into the Fourier domain, we can see there's a really beautiful strong peak in this subject at 4 hertz. We have a stereotypical auditory cortical response here. We have a source sink and a sink source in each hemisphere. And when we ask them to do the masker task, so these are still present, but they're not being sought after, then we also get a peak at 4 hertz, but it's greatly reduced. Now, this is just one subject, but if we look at all subjects, we can see that this happened either a huge amount or less so in every subject we looked at. And if we just average over subjects, then at 4 hertz, there's this great enhancement when you're attending to that, when you're looking for that. And when you look at neighboring frequencies, there's nothing going on.
So concerning the variability between subjects, I can see that there's a big variability depending on physiology and so on, like how strong the response is. But then the difference between, say, attended and unattended, naively, you would expect that to be very similar from subject to subject. But well, it's not really the case, right? How do you explain that?
So I'm going to take the opposite tact. I'm saying in most papers, you'll never see this data, because all it takes is 3 quarters to be like this, and the other quarter can have the opposite sign, and you found a statistically significant effect. And in this case, we found the right sign for every subject. So that by itself makes this a very robust effect. Some of these subjects perform the task better than others, and some of them, for whatever reasons, it's less of a strong magnetic effect. But in this case, I would say it's a very strong, robust effect.
I don't doubt the effect. I don't really know what you think about the variability that many people see and that
seems to be there. So we've decreased the variability across subjects by using a manipulation here. I lost a little word here, but this should be normalized neural response. These are actually the response at 4 hertz in power divided by power in neighboring bands. Because it turns out the power in 4 hertz across subjects varies wildly. But if you normalize it by the power in neighboring bands, then it really reduces it a lot. There may be other things that could reduce it further, but there also just is subject-to-subject variability. And I'm definitely not going to try to explain that here with this experiment. I also just want to mention Avaninen. Did a related study, much better in the sense they used MEG, EEG, and fMRI all in the same experiment and found related results. Also, just to put together more perception with the neural response, it turned out, and this was not planned by us, that when the repeating target, the rhythmic target, was a low frequency versus a high frequency, when it was a high frequency, it popped out. And this was a totally unexpected effect because all of our tones fell within one octave. So we're talking about being in the upper half of an octave versus the lower half of an octave. But when it was high, you could just hear beep, 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 beep. I mean, it was just clear as day. You didn't have to search for it. It was not a Where's Waldo experiment anymore. And all of these were roved. So that happened some of the time. So behaviorally, people, the subjects did much better at finding the deviant when it popped out, when it was high, but also neurally, the neural response went up and tracked that. Interestingly, when they were doing the other task, and so therefore should not have been affected by anything going on in the stream, when the target went from low to high, they did worse behaviorally, as implying that it was interfering with their task. And also we could see that the neural response also went up, although at a much lower level than the neural response in the attended case. And then similarly in the time domain, These deviants were randomly scattered throughout the first 5 seconds of this stream, and so we could track what's called a buildup, which is how long it takes before this signal can be acquired, and we can do that behaviorally, and we can do that neurally, and we can see they track each other reasonably well. All right, so this is, we again have this this percept. In this case, the percept is really, it's directionally derived. You can, it's attentionally derived. The percept is you have a task. If you are tasked with hearing this rhythmic stream, you can find it and hear it. If you're not tasked with it, especially if you're tasked with something not involved with it, you tend not to hear it. But the presence or absence of the rhythm is something subjectively that's really profound once you lock in. We can completely screw up this experiment by playing just one beat of that rhythmic tone before the masker turns on, and then you've locked in and you can't get rid of it. So this is very high level, contextual, cognitive things going on here in terms of the processing of these sounds. Sorry?
Why does it take seconds?
Over seconds. This temporal buildup? Because it's like a Where's Waldo kind of search algorithm. Sometimes you find Waldo quickly, sometimes you find it takes a long time, and when you average over trials, you get this buildup over time. In each individual trial, it's more likely nothing and then step up. And then you average over them and you get this buildup. And we've seen this as both bottom-up and top-down. Thank you, Malcolm, for introducing those concepts. And we also get this association in the time domain. I'll do this one quickly. This is an experiment that was suggested by Shihab. In this case, it's much more of a listening to speaker A and speaker B at a cocktail party effect. We have two tone streams, a fast one and a slow one. One of them is higher, one of them is lower. They're all roved. The relationship between them is roved. And we have the subjects listen for temporal deviance in one or the other. So by that, we get to attend to one stream or the other. And when they're tracking the 4 hertz, these are 4 hertz and 7 hertz, so 4 hertz is called the slow task, they have a nice strong 4 hertz. When they're tracking the 7 hertz, their 4 hertz is reduced. And if you look at the 7 hertz, when they're tracking the 4 hertz, you get the 7 hertz response. When they're tracking the 7 hertz, it goes up. So in both of these cases, we see an enhancement of the neural representation of the sound that's being attended. This is in one subject. Oh yes, I just wanted to notice, you have to compare these things vertically and not horizontally, because what's going on at 4 hertz, what's going on at 7 hertz is related to all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the task. But 4 hertz you can always compare with 4 hertz, and 7 hertz you can always compare with 7 hertz. And so when we look at that averaged over subjects, we can see that at 4 hertz it goes up. We see 7 hertz, it also goes up, but with the opposite sign, so we're drawing it downwards, just like in the previous figure. And we see this also strong relationship in the buildup, both behaviorally and neurally. There was also a pretty nice experiment done very similar to this with depth electrodes. And in that case, they used 21 hertz and 29 hertz. We had chosen 4 and 7 because those are nice, those rates if you're interested in speech. I later talked to the researcher who led this and asked, how could you possibly choose 21 and 29? What was the basis? And she said, oh, we tried all different ranges, and these are the ones that gave the strongest effect. So it's definitely real, but the particular reason there that it's those values may not have anything to do with any kind of speech processing or otherwise. All right, so we're a little bit closer to the cocktail party with those because we've got the direct A-B comparison. Still not quite there because one is fast and one is slow, and those are different. And also, we're not there because it's not speech. I wasn't going to put this in, but since it came up this morning, I'm just providing this reference here. This is Maria Chait, and Alan is also a co-author on this paper. I mentioned this just addressing one of the questions. If you actively ignore or suppress a stimulus, you can actually reduce it. So these attentional modulations, they tend to go up if you're looking to amplify something, to attend to something, but with the right behavioral incentive, you can also suppress it. All right, so just to summarize these simple, complex scenes, these have all been tone-based, no speech yet. We dissociate the neural responses from the physical acoustics. These responses that from 100 milliseconds latency, which in some cases can be localized to pons temporale, not primary auditory cortex, seems to track the perception. And we've seen different roles of attention. In the first cases, we saw that there wasn't any special directed attention, although attention may have played a role in whether an ambiguous percept is one or the other. But we see it in both cases, and we saw this for both bottom-up and top-down types of attention. All right, so let's talk about speech. So people familiar with spectrograms in speech will recognize that this looks a lot like speech, and we even have the words here. This is from Barbshin Cunningham's chapter in that book, by the way. So these are the words 3, 5, 3, 4, 3, 4, 2. Very regular, very rhythmic. Here's another example of speech. You can also tell this is speech if you're familiar with speech. This is more natural speech. It's sort of regular, but it's not terribly regular. This is another example of speech. And for people very familiar with speech spectrograms, you might be able to tell what this is. Yeah, see, there are people very familiar. It's the sum of the other two. And now I'll let you know that what this little speech fragment here says is, it's hard to understand two things at once. Barb's great. So the kind of experiments we're going to do now are really listening to this. And when you're listening to this, in the auditory nerve, you don't get blue neurons and red neurons. You get the auditory nerve is responding to the sound. That's what it's supposed to do. But by the time it gets to some part of cortex that connects to our perception, we perceive it as this mixture of these two different sounds.
Segmentation between the two is possible, and it must be extremely highly nonlinear, right? It must require cortical, many layers of cortical processing, right? Because it's so, if this is truly the input. Right?
You tell me how many hidden layers you think it needs.
I don't know, but it looks even more complex than what we have to do for object recognition, for visual object.
But so those are feed-forward networks, and we have intrinsically feedback networks also. Shiham, do you want to guess at how many synapses there are between one? Between completely mixed and unmixing.
Well, nobody knows for speech, but for simple stimuli, you get evidence of categorical representations with the two or three synapses from the court, from the A1.
But for speech?
For speech, maybe one.
Another synapse.
Just one more.
I'm sure it depends on what the qualities of the speakers are.
But this must be, so if this was two, these are two speakers, right? So this must be trained and learned.
No. We don't just walk around and have to learn everybody's voice when you are sitting in the restaurant there and there's all these people talking, you can trivially go on any speaker.
But you get a lifetime of experience of hearing.
You can easily focus even if you don't know the language.
Well, if they're mixed into a single channel, that's actually hard. But if they're spatially segregated at all, it's easy.
Even if it's single channel, you can tell from the continuity of the pitch or voice quality and all these things.
That's all. I mean.
So from my experience in looking at this from an experimentalist point of view, what can we see, what can't we see? And we haven't shown neural results, but whenever this is an easy task, and there's many ways this can be an easy task, we see strong neural correlates of that. And when it's a hard task, that it takes some training or some experience, or it even can't be done, then we don't see the neural correlates of it. No. Yeah, so these arrows are definitely pointing forward, not backwards. Right, and I don't know of any evidence that there are individuals who can listen to both speakers at the same time and report. There may be. There are people who can do this with music. But I think most people can't. But I think that there are individuals who can.
You can hear it several times.
First listening. But there are people who can tell you what day of the week, you know, the 1st of January, 44 BC was. I can't tell you that. Okay, so how are we looking at the responses to speech? Because speech is more complicated than pure tones. I'll talk about this in more detail on Friday during my shorter talk. But basically, we're using linear models, taking either the spectrotemporal envelope or just the temporal envelope of the speech. The linear model is just a kernel which will map these fluctuations in power into fluctuations in neural response. And I've drawn only one neural response here. Actually, I've drawn two, which I've drawn the one that's actually in your brain and the one that in black that comes out of our neural model prediction with this STRF. But there's, in fact, one of these going on at every single channel we measure, or potentially every single auditory source in the brain. So you know where these are coming from, we use long duration speech stimuli, typically 60 seconds. And the frequencies we're talking about in our kernel go up to about 10 hertz. And that makes sense because we're not talking about any fine structure in the stimulus. We're talking only about envelope cues. So the speed of your lips moving, your vocal cords changing, those kinds of rates. They're hand designed. It's you can do it using standard linear methods. We use a modified version of that. They're derived from the data. I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood. They're derived from the data in each case. Yeah.
So they are learned. I'm sorry. They're estimated from the data.
They're estimated. Absolutely. We also do the opposite. We can take all of the neural responses, come up with a matrix called a decoder, and from that estimate what the original speech envelope was. With MEG, we can't estimate, we don't have enough independent sources to estimate what the spectrotemporal envelope was. We can only do just the plain temporal envelope. So this is the kind of thing where we do, where red is 10 seconds worth of an actual speech envelope, and green is our attempt to reconstruct it from the neural response. When we do these same techniques with ECOG, we actually get quite similar results. So it's pretty astounding to me that using the same technique with MEG and ECOG, you can get the same kind of resolution. The green is from MEG, the red is from the speech itself. Now this is hand chosen. What?
How many subjects before you got something?
Oh, I don't know. This is probably 1 in 5. But this is from 10 seconds out of 60.
You're not averaging multiple presentations.
No. You can, and it helps a little bit. We typically do 3 presentations of 60 seconds. We are interested in principle and whether the first one is different than the third one, but we haven't found any systematic differences.
Looks like your reconstruction here is a sort of low-pass version of the actual speech envelope work. Is there some reason for that?
That's probably because the neural response is low-passed. The neural activity goes like 1 over F. The low frequencies are really much higher than the high frequencies. And we did not give a 1 over F low-pass filter to our stimulus envelope. So there are things that we can't see in the response, so we can't predict in the stimulus.
So do you think that what looks like higher frequencies that you can reconstruct over half a second duration?
Yeah, I wouldn't read, this is so good though compared to our normal that I wouldn't read too much into this. Our typical correlations are 0.3. And if I showed you 0.3, you'd go, that's not very good. All right, so one of the reasons we're using this in the cocktail party is since we can use MEG, the neural responses to reconstruct the speech envelope, if there's two people talking, we can ask the question, which envelope should we reconstruct? Should we reconstruct the envelope of both of them talking at the same time, of the one they're attending to, the one they're not attending to? These become reasonable questions. And that's what this cartoon means, is when we have a subject with that subject's brain listening to someone else talk, this is the red person talking, then we have a neural representation which, given a linear filter, which is this reconstruction filter, they have a representation of the envelope in their brain. And what we're interested in, because we're interested in the percept, when you're attending to one of two people talking at the same time, is if you're attending to the red person, the green person is talking, doesn't care about what the red person is saying, but you care, and you only care about what the red person's saying. We want to look for the representation coming from auditory cortex that looks like what the red person is saying that has nothing to do with what the green person is saying. Yeah.
May I know which part of the brain is more active during this process?
So we haven't gotten there yet, but it's planum temporale. It's this higher order, non-primary cortex. So this would what we would expect if there were unselective coding or non-selective coding. This would be, for instance, if you were recording a low-pass version of the signal coming from subcortically, you would expect that it would not care about the direction of attention. It would just be reconstructing the envelope of the entire auditory scene. But by that same token, if we suddenly become interested in the green person instead of the red person, then for the exact same stimulus, we expect a dramatically different neural response when we're looking at this kind of selective neural encoding. So we did this experiment with my student Nai Ding, and here we have in gray is the speech envelope of speaker A, and this gray is the speech envelope of speaker B. And in red here is the reconstructed speech envelope of speaker A. And here is the reconstructed envelope of speaker B. These are identical stimuli. So there's no acoustic difference between the stimuli. And these are the same filters that have been applied to both. And that's key. We want to use the same reconstruction filter. They're not separately tuned. This is just tuned for the attended speaker reconstruction, whatever it is. This is for one fragment of speech, but if we do this for all trials, all listeners, both speakers, and we just do a simple measure of linear correlation between the reconstructed stimulus and the actual stimulus, we find that we do a very good job. And if you want to know which one they're listening to, then just by looking at which one is bigger, in this case, you can do that and be correct 92% of the time. Yeah?
So this is a beautiful result. And do you imagine that that's only possible if you have parallel representations of those two speech streams in the brain that you then pick up with your EEG? Like, so in theory, you're picking them up at the same time, but maybe the operation is to simply increase the amplitude or the synchrony, the reliability of whatever signal's going into making that EEG.
They're not picking up at the same time.
Yeah, this, so...
Well, there's, teeter-totter going back and forth between the brain response being maximal for one or the other.
Well, there's nothing quick happening here in the sense these are integrated over 60 seconds to get the reliability, to get this correlation here.
Right. But so you think it's an increase in amplitude of the signal that they're attending to. Do you agree with that?
I think that so this is... I think that gets into my problem with the term attentional modulation.
Okay.
It's not that one signal has been increased over the other, it's that the two have been separated at all, and then once they've been separated, one is bigger. And I'm pretty sure that that the separation and the amplification are part and parcel of the same processing.
When you say separation, it sort of suggests that they're representations of both at the same time, which could or could not be the case.
Right. So,
you could hypothesize that when you're attending to one, essentially suppressing everything in one, so you have only one.
So let me just bring this up while we're talking about this, because I can also do the same thing for the background speech, and I do a worse job. I can still do it, but it's still there. And I would agree with Alain that this is not that we are segregating them, and then once they're segregated, we have a choice of A or B. It's that part of this attentional process is we are segregating them because we wanted to pick out speaker A, and therefore that is pulled out, and whatever is left, the background may still be there, but we're not segregating. For instance, if there were three speakers, we don't believe that there are A, B, and C all equally represented, and then we pick one of them out, amplify that, and leave the others. It could be, and this doesn't really address that, but having that, what one of the things that makes this a simple complex scene is there's only two speakers, and in general our sound scenes have many more sound sources than two. Yeah.
For engineering this sort of can help asking, did you ever try just to use this reconstructed envelope to modulate this mix of the two speakers?
No, we haven't done any feedback like that.
What
but there are certainly people who care about that, because in order to help people with the cocktail party problem, if there were some means of estimating which sound source they cared about, then maybe that one could be amplified. All right, I'm going to go over this part quickly, but the same question can be asked about loudness changes. So for instance, if two people are talking at different volumes, we really don't have any trouble following the one at a louder volume or the softer volume, as long as they're, in our case, plus or minus 8 dB apart in signal and target to masker ratio, then it's not a hard problem if you've got a healthy auditory system. And we wouldn't expect that to change the neural representation of the attended speaker. And that is, in fact, what we find, that for speaker relative intensity from minus 8 dB up to plus 8 dB, it's pretty much flat for all of the attended, and it's pretty much flat for all of the background.
So this would have been interesting to follow for lower signal-to-noise ratios, right, to see how that breaks down as you lose intelligibility, or you lose the ability to comprehend.
Yes. In hindsight, and for experiments we did after this, we always tried to go past the edge.
So this is great data, and Ed Lally reviewed this and that as well for EEG. But one thing he did was he showed human performance on these tests, along the lines of what Tobias was saying. The correlation we got in these results, like what Todd was talking about, went down as people's test performance went down.
So I will talk about that on on Friday a little bit. We didn't do that with this experiment, but when we did speech in stationary noise, then we did do that, and we found something similar there. Although we found that it was mostly affected by the slow components, delta, more than theta. We can do the same thing. Everything I've shown you was a man and a woman. We can do the same thing with two women talking at the same time. Do this with fewer subjects, but it's the same idea. This is a significantly harder task, where significantly means in the statistical sense, instead of being able to do with no training whatsoever, it takes probably a good 15 seconds of training before you can do it. All right, then the forward model, looking at the STRF, is what we use actually to do the localization with. So we can do the forward model using the STRF, we can ask what's the kernel that takes the attended speech into the neural response? What's the kernel that takes the background speech into the neural response? These both give spectrotemporal response fields. They turn out to be, for this set of measurements, very, very separable. And so we can literally just take out the spectral component and look at only the temporal component. That makes it easier to compare them. And we can see that the background TRF, there's no spectrum here anymore, versus the attended TRF, are very similar at 50 milliseconds, but they're quite different at 100 milliseconds. Yeah?
Is this for one channel or all channels?
No, this is all channels.
So is it, you're doing this across all channels?
This is all channels. We use a spatial filter. We've tried this with DSS. We've tried this with dipole models. We've tried this with other models. It's robust against the spatial filter. And so it's not all channels individually. It's a weighted sum of all of the channels. It also works with a weighted sum of the left hemisphere channels versus the right hemisphere channels.
So actually you're arguing for complete separability between channel and frequency and time?
No, I wouldn't argue for that. That's a function of...
That's
what I'm doing here, but that's a function of signal to noise of your data quality, of your neural data. And then, since this is happening at each channel, then we can ask, what is the magnetic field configuration at this time? What is the magnetic field configuration at that time? We can ask, where does this source localize to? Where does this source localize to? And, oh, here's also where I mentioned Ed's work, Ed Lauer's work. So very similar results for EEG. EEG looks at different things than MEG. They find this modulation not at 100 milliseconds, but later. But that's because EEG and MEG can have access to different things. They see a peak at 100 milliseconds, but it's not segregated by attention. Is that what? Both, yeah. Although these are hand drawn; these are not error bars.
But it's very similar response for that case, right?
Yes. Okay. So when we localize, we find that the 100 millisecond one, like in the previous experiments, localizes to plantar temporale, this higher order, later area, and that the 50 millisecond one localizes. It's consistent with Heschel's gyrus. It's a little messy, but it's certainly not localizing to one of these higher order areas. And it's this plantar temporale that its strength is being modulated by attention, but not Heschel's gyrus. And so this, when I say this attentional modulation here, this is modulation of the response at plantar temporale. So by that time, it seems to have been separated. And once it's been separated, I have no trouble saying, yes, this is modulated up, this is not modulated up. But the general attentional modulation of a response doesn't make sense to me, because when you've got the mixed speech, what is there to modulate? Pure tone, great. Just pull it up, that's fine. But for the mixed speech, you have to segregate it. It's a derived process to do the segregation before you can amplify anything. Yeah.
So, do you imagine, the speech is very complicated to do this, but let's say you had, in your oddball pass that you described, you could have the person recognize, there's a rhythm and then there's a little oddball with their time and frequency, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you were to vary vary both the 50 the 50 millisecond one and the long one? In other words, is there a perceptual integration time or an attentional integration time that's fixed? Obviously, this is an average, 100 milliseconds, it's an average. But would you see, would you imagine it varies with some kind of operation in the brain that you could track if it, you had a reaction time measure?
It can vary a little bit. So when the noise, if we're doing speech in stationary noise, then these responses can be delayed. So there is, when there's extra processing needs, there seems to be extra processing latency. But that, I'm not going to put anything beyond that. Those are just convenient words. The modulation occurs by attention, but this is from all of the different relative intensity curves. Changing the actual volume, the loudness of the sound, doesn't affect the peak. I want to mention Nima's work, because he did this.
This is a linear model, so in changing intensity should cause the response to change, right?
Changing the relative intensity?
Oh, I'm sorry,
yeah. So for instance, it could, if we believe that divisive normalization is occurring here, which is a pretty good assumption, it could be divisively normalized by the sound scene, or it could be divisively normalized by the stream of attention, and it looks to be the stream of attention.
Any other amplitude is not, the amplitude of the brain response is not directly proportional to the amplitude of the acoustic signal.
Yeah, it's not linear in that sense. All right, so if you do this with ECOG, you have multiple independent sources because you have access, you have many electrodes on the surface of the brain. So you can actually reconstruct the spectrogram and not just the envelope. And so this is two different examples for single speech, not mixed. But when you do it for the mixed case, then when attending to speaker one, the reconstructed spectrogram looks like that speaker's, and the same thing for speaker two. And interestingly, this only works if you average only on successful trials. If you average on over trial, if you include trials where the subject messed up the answer to the question, then you don't get this faithful representation. Also interesting, they did not observe any spatial pattern consistently over auditory cortex. They couldn't say, this is happening here, that's happening there. It seemed to be somewhat random, depending on where the electrodes are, and that does seem to be consistent with ECOG experiments, that you, even though you have this incredible spatial precision, that a neighboring electrode can see something completely different, and you go two electrodes over, and that can look like the first one.
In the NIST trials, does the spectrum look like that of the unattended speaker, or is it just a mess?
I don't know. There may not have been.
What was the question?
If you average only over the missed trials, what does it look like? Yeah.
I think
you did do it. Yeah, I don't remember. It depending on what the subject's doing, it might look like the mixture if they just weren't paying attention, and it might look like the unattended stimulus if they were doing the wrong task. This is another experiment which done ECOG. The experiment just before, like most ECOG experiments, uses only the high gamma envelope of the response because that's strongly correlated with spiking activity. But you don't have to use that. You can use low frequency, like between 0 and 10 hertz, like we did with MEG. So in this experiment, that's just single talker, so that's obvious. That's the easy case. For reconstructing the attended stimulus, it doesn't matter that much whether you're using low frequency or high frequency. In this case, low frequency actually did a little bit better, but they're both good. If you use the wrong decoder, then you get nonsense. One of the nice things about this experiment is that it's more of a bridging experiment between typical ECOG experiments and EEG, MEG experiments. Here's also something about the spatial, looks like I've got less than 5 minutes. This spatial arrangement of the electrodes, which give good reconstruction, For high gamma, they're typically in auditory cortex, which is this area over here, but there's plenty that are not in auditory cortex. These are the ones that are good at reconstructing the ignored or background stimulus. When you look at low frequencies, you actually get a much broader spread. So this to me says that the auditory representations are certainly not coming only from auditory cortex. And with MEG and EG, if we're localizing, they may be dominantly coming from it, but some of the spread we see may not just be from error, it may actually be from other areas, and that's especially true for the low frequency responses.
Do you know the full spectrum version at this point?
What?
Is this ECOG?
This is ECOG.
So you're doing full spectrum gamma version.
Full what?
Spectrum gamma version. Full spectrum gamma.
This, I think, this was just the temporal envelope. I don't believe that NEMA has seen this, and I'm not sure it was done in this experiment. The electrodes are spaced pretty much too far to do that.
So you're covering a lot of area.
Yeah. Yeah, so this messiness here, I mean, with EEG, you can say, well, I'm seeing responses from the wrong part of the brain because there's return currents coming through. There's current spread. That current spread also gives electrical potentials that we can measure. Since these are just isolated points, then if there were a current spread issue, it should be affecting all of the electrodes in a neighborhood. And each of these electrodes really acts individually and independently. There's very little consistency from neighboring electrodes to another. It's not what you would expect from, say, a multi-electrode array that you put down. You expect to find neurons that are behaving similar to each other, at least in some ways. Here, they're too far apart for that to be true, and in fact, we're seeing that they're processing the sounds very differently. Yeah?
Do you see any evidence that activity at one site is somehow influenced by activity at another site?
I have not seen that analysis, so I don't know. All right, so I'm going to skip fMRI. This is bottom up, top down. This is important. This is the question, how does this all occur? And I'm going to push that onto Shihab, who's going to talk about that when he gives his seminar. And then the last thing I'll cover very, very quickly, which is, so there's a question, and then Alana answered this also. Sometimes we only care about what direction the auditory attention is. Can we guess that? And sort of Malcolm certainly addressed that. And this team from Telluride includes Nima, Barb Shin Cunningham, Malcolm, Shihab, and Lalor, found that they could do this in single trials with a correctness in the 80s. Those trials were 60 seconds? 60 seconds? Oh, so. Sorry, so it's direction, it's the attentional direction only. It's they're listening to two speakers mixed into a single channel.
No.
And so it's just, it's a bad word. Is attention focused on the male or is it focused on the female? Directed is bad. But it does lead me into this question of attentional dynamics. So this is new work I've been doing with Baitash Babadi and here with a former student of Shihab's, Sahar. This is a model which basically just tries to look at whether the M100 is bigger or smaller for speaker one, for speaker two, and it can track it dynamically, not over 60 seconds. So in this case, we're looking at the probability of attending speaker one, and for these three subjects, when they are instructed to attend to speaker one, then we get a pretty consistent prediction that they are, whereas when they're attending to speaker two, two of the subjects do great, but one of the subjects we can see has decided that either the experiment is too boring or too hard, but is no longer following the instructions. And we can see that from the dynamics here. And when we do a different experiment where we specifically ask them to switch experiment in the middle of the 30 seconds, we can follow that as well. And then more recently, we've been able to do this not by looking just at the M100, but by estimating the TRF itself, the entire TRF, moment by moment, we have about a 5-second resolution here And we can see here that at this moment in time, 20 seconds in, we've got a nice strong M100 for speaker one, and it's pretty weak for speaker two. But after the attention switch over here, we've got a nice strong M100 for speaker two, not so for speaker one, but we also have access to the other, the entire TRF, and we can compare, for instance, the M50, the M100, any other other features we want.
From the quick onset, I take it these are not naive. That is, people already know voices one and two before they run this paradigm.
So by the time the experiment's been run a few times, absolutely. But we do actually have naive listeners coming in and listening to each for the first time, and we see no differences between their first trial and any other trials after that. So it really does seem to be the speech that they're processing, not the content. And I think my time is up, so I'm going to skip the remaining parts of the talk, unless someone stops me because they see something interesting. All right, so I'll do this very, very quickly. So just for the people who don't know, 30 seconds on, if you put a gap in a tone, then you hear a gap in a tone. But if you put noise in that gap, you perceive the tone running through that gap in the noise. So this is not published. But my student Francisco wants to know if that happens with a rhythmic stimulus also. So he's got here this is a constant tone stimulus with some very sharp FM modulation, so the little very brief chirps, and then he applies a noise masker, and sometimes that noise masker just covers up the same rhythmic stimulus, but sometimes the noise masker covers up just a pure tone. And we see typical response. This is from one subject, averaged over all responses, that when there is a rhythmic signature in the stimulus, we see rhythmic following in the response, and when there isn't, we see much messier response, not consistent with the rhythmic. But we also ask these subjects and design these stimuli so that as close to half the time as we could arrange it, they actually heard this even when there wasn't one. So they reported hearing, and I've heard this myself, you can hear a rhythm there. It's very faint and it's very noisy, but you're sure it's there. It turns out that it wasn't there. The entire experiment lasts about an hour, and these are 4 seconds, 3 seconds. It's enough for a dozen periods. Oh, sorry, and these are 5 hertz.
5 hertz.
5 hertz.
So it's 5 per second.
Yeah, 5 per second.
So did I understand correctly there? So the orange curve is the actual acoustic signal does not have that rhythm in that gap period.
Yeah.
Although sometimes people do hear it.
Right.
So it means that no response, so to speak, does not, well, that particular response at least does not predict that perception.
Right. And so what we did, and you'll see this next slide, is we analyzed this data over all subjects, but bandpass centered at 5 hertz, so we could see what was really going on there. And there's cases where the rhythm is there in the stimulus, but it may be perceived as there or perceived as absent, and cases where the rhythm is not there, but perceived as there, so that's the filling in case, or perceived as absence. And so we can analyze these 4 cases separately. And the more interesting one is when there's no stimulus, there's no rhythmic stimulus, but it's sometimes perceived as being there, sometimes perceived as absent. And when it's perceived as absent, then the 5 hertz goes way down. But when it's perceived as being present, there is substantial 5 hertz activity in auditory cortex during that range. And it's comparable to the activity that you see here when the rhythm is actually present. So it's somewhat variable, and it's not phase locked. I'm not showing you there, showing that data. But the actual amount of 5 hertz content is there, and it's there only when the absent stimulus is perceived as being there. And it's a rhythm. It's not just the presence of a tone, it's an actual beat.
So you only have ever one rhythm? Is this preliminary?
For this experiment, we only have one rhythm. Maybe, if there's time on Friday, I may talk about the speech restoration. All right, so that's the end of my talk. So the main idea was to talk about representations of acoustic stimuli and perceived stimuli and how they are related, but they can be separated. When they can be separated, the ones that correspond to the percept, in particular, not always, especially at the beginning, but towards for the last two-thirds of these talks, it's the ones that are attended. It's the auditory foreground. Those are in the planum temporale. This happens with about 100 milliseconds latency. We saw some evidence that this this foreground is dynamic and can be dynamically monitored on a scale of at least 5 milliseconds, possibly faster if we can get better SNR. And I also just want to bring up this point that attentional modulation, which is a widely thrown around term, and I use it all the time, one should be very, very careful of it in the cocktail party scenario. Because it's one thing to say the response of a tone is attentionally modulated. It's another to say that mixed speech has one speaker modulated upward, because that presumes that it's already been separated. And I would say it's pretty likely that attention itself is a key part of that separation process. And that's all I have to say. Thanks. I have not tried time reverse speech. I have an aversion to time reverse speech because it doesn't sound like speech. The statistics of time reverse speech are not. The spectrum, of course, is exactly the same, but the spectrotemporal properties are quite different. No, I think it's also a poor control because of attention. It's easy to listen to speech, and it's hard to listen to time reverse speech.
The acoustic properties are very simple. In fact, it's reverse means that all the nonsense are offsets.
Well, that's why I asked. There's no really rule number two, so can you do it with only those two left?
Yeah. So I think I think there are better controls than time reverse speech. Yeah, he has. And it's useful in certain contexts. He uses it in a parameterization argument, saying that the whatever dimensions you need for reversed and forward speech, it's the same amount of activity, same amount of dimensionality in both. And so he shows that one of the effects he's getting by using a more higher dimensional model is doing better because it does better, not just because it's higher dimensional. Yeah, John.
So the claim that there's some stuff happening in PT, that's mostly coming from your MEG data?
That's all from the MEG data, not just mine, but all from MEG.
How confident are you in the source localization?
It's a very reasonable question. I think that the dominant source, I feel very confident the dominant source is planum temporale. But I also think that some of the source is actually from motor cortex and sensory motor cortex. And so because of confounds like that, it could be much more widely distributed, and I wouldn't know. It's consistent with if there's a single source that it's planum temporale. But that's a dubious assumption. It's the same kind of argument that's used for EEG in general. Whenever you see an N1, you know it's the N1. So you can rely on any research anyone has done on N1s, including where it comes from, how many components there are. That makes N1 very reliable as a marker. But we don't actually know what its many sources are. We know what happens if you assume it's made from a small number of sources.
I'm just trying to reconcile this with what we know about the representation of speech, which we typically think doesn't actually have a whole lot to do with the planum temporale, right? It's mostly FTG where you're getting
speech?
Where people are attending the speaker, right? They're able to reconstruct.
Yeah. So I would agree. I don't think this is specific to speech. We see an ulcer for pure tones.
No, I understand. Wouldn't you expect that there would be a signal emanating from the locus of speech representation that would enable you to represent?
Oh, okay. So this planotemporalis source is really big, and it swamps anything that's nearby in time. So unless it's real, unless this other later source is very reliable in terms of its timing and its orientation, it will tend to be averaged out just by not having good enough SNR. I focus on these two peaks because they're big and reliable. There's plenty of other peaks that are less big and less reliable, and some of them are even quite reliable, but I don't see the reliability, only my students do. So there's definitely more going on there. One of the things that before I did this work, I just had a single speech stream going through auditory cortex, and there, all of auditory cortex, as far as I can see, likes the speech. And so what this is doing is it's segregating out the difference between speech and an attended stream. And so what one needs to do speech, in this case, would be experiments that are more like yours, where you have speech versus something that is very, very much like speech, but is not speech, and to see what the differences are. And for those, if you could do some subtraction, then maybe you could see a later speech-centered origin. But I don't think this is the speech center. I think this is the place that speech is being processed along the way.
So for the speech processing area, I guess for these differences between male and female speakers, you said if you have male or female speaker, it's actually a lot more difficult to segregate them.
If they're both the same sex, it's harder.
Exactly. So, or same sex, yeah. So obviously there's a difference in pitch between male and female speaker on average. Is that most of the feature that's driving that, or what are the other features?
Yeah, I don't think it's most, because for the data that I showed, the two female speakers that we happened to use actually had a larger average pitch difference than the male and female speaker we did. So it wasn't pitch. It must have been other timbre cues, and as far as I can tell, it may even be a categorical distinction of this set of pitches and timbres is female, and then so therefore we can separate that out from this other one, which is male. And I believe that because I'm not showing data from our three-speaker experiment, but there we have a man, a woman, and a child. And that's doable, but a man and two women is not, and two men and a woman is not. But man, woman, and child, as long as they're, you've got the three different categories, then you can do that.
Any ideas for how the actual segregation processing might be happening?
We're going to wait for Shihab for that.
Okay.
the neural filling in, some people, it's a kind of holy grail. I mean, everybody wants to see this kind of thing. Is there an actual filling in somewhere? It's a basic question. One way of seeing of explaining the perceptual phenomenon is that it's not that you heard the tone continue, mm-hmm. it's that you did not hear it stop.
Mm-hmm.
So since you did not hear it stop, you make an inference.
Right.
So any question that you can ask to the subject, did it continue or didn't it continue? Well, they didn't hear it turn off. Since it didn't turn off, they have no evidence that it turned off. It must have continued. So yeah, of course they heard it.
So here they didn't hear the rhythm turning off.
Rhythm. So it would be really nice to have an objective neural correlate of something that is reconstructed within the brain. Tone if it's a tone, rhythm if it's a rhythm.
Speech if it's speech.
Speech if it's speech. But it's really elusive. I mean, lots of people have been looking for that, and there's not all that much that's convincing. Here you have really great data, but you haven't actually published it.
Well, he just defended his thesis. His corrections were required by his committee. Oh, yeah.
There is precedent in vision. If you go behind an occluder, then...
Not perceptually, right. Yeah, but is there something...
I thought there was a little data from John Mansell. But I mean,
so you see actually a persistent original topic shape?
Well, no, just persistent firing of neurons with perceptive fields in that area after the actual stimulus has gone behind an occluder. So you're no longer seeing it.
Yeah, the visual system, they have shown it.
Okay, I mean, but it's, I've yet to see really strong evidence.
Well, I can't suggest you as a reviewer because you're...
one point, you said that you did the five hertz bandpass filtering.
Yeah.
You have to be really careful with that because...
Yes.
Suppose your filter has a Q of 5.
Yep.
It has an impulse response that extends over...
Absolutely have to be careful.
Fill in the...
Yep, yep. And so we have, so you need controls. You need to have the cases where you can't see it.
Yeah.
And it also...
Something like apply Fourier transform, instead of using a bandpass filter, Fourier transform so that you exclude completely the data outside.
And it turns out you also have to take into account in a detailed way the number of occurrences these detections occurred. Because the small number statistics have different biases in your statistical outcomes than larger. So yes, you have to do it right or you'll get the wrong answer.
So in the, just making a link to the visual field, so the experiments done there to try and discern with ambiguous stimuli, so like the Necker cube or those face phase illusions where you can either perceive the face or you either perceive two faces or one face.
Mm-hmm.
So the same stimuli, but two equally good percepts possible. They found that the hot zones of the neural correlates were in IT, inferotemporal. So at the end of this ventral stream of processing, when all these invariants had been sort of already, all the invariants had been built up.
Yeah, I worry about the use of the word the end of visual cortex, but go on.
Where the first object representations show up, where all the nuisances have been kind of factored out or dealt with to a large extent.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Is that true for planum temporale? Is it analogous to IT in the sense that all the nuisances in the auditory cortex have been factored out and now we have this, you know, is it analogous to IT in that sense?
There's no evidence for that. This is early evidence for it, but there's nothing else going on. The main thing that planum temporale is known for is having strong responses that depend on task, that depend on attention, that depend strongly on the stimulus and context. And now we're seeing that it looks like all of that is because of stream segregation. And that's why task matters, that's why attention matters. But it's a big place. It's a whole plane, planum temporale, and there's probably many things that it's doing there.
All right, thanks very much again.
Thank you.